witnesses were officers of the Nigerian army who made their presentations in court while journalists stay outside.
They gave evidence about the operation, of the military operation that lasted between the 12th and the 14th of December 2015, and the role played by each of them. We just want to see how far we can go tomorrow. The case would, the prosecution is not likely to close the case tomorrow. So we'll then take other days so that we can speedily, you know, have this matter concluded.
Sheikh Ibrahim Zazaki is being tried for culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other allegations, which the Islamic movement has described as fabricated and baseless. In December 2015, soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked Zazaki's home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters. No soldier has been charged for the mass murders of Zazaki's supporters, despite the recommendation of a judicial commission of inquiry set up by the Kaduna state government. Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention for close to 5 years in violation of the ruling of a federal high court ordering for his release.
The Nigerian judiciary is a very independent judiciary. So by the grace of Allah, there is going to be a way out for Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, in as much as the Nigerian judiciary remain independent. Definitely there is going to be a way out for Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki through the constitutional means.
Despite being a public trial, no journalist or any member of the Zazaki family has ever been allowed inside the courtroom. Meanwhile, Zazaki supporters have continued to demand for his release in accordance with the order of a federal high court in Abuja. Tanjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has been projected the winner in the disputed U.S. presidential vote. That means in about 2 months, Donald Trump will have to hand in power to Biden. His administration, however, is using every opportunity to take controversial steps. On Thursday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo paid a visit to an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank to further consolidate Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands.
During the Trump administration, America stands with Israel like never before. Indeed, the commitment we've made, the ironclad commitment we've made to the Jewish state, will continue.
Pompeo said the U.S. will label the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign as anti-Semitic and cancerous. He said Washington will require that imports from Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank be labeled as made in Israel. In 2016, the United Nations Security Council adopted a resolution to reaffirm the illegality of Israeli settlements. Referring to Israelis as an occupying power, the resolution called on Israel to stop settlement constructions and abide by its obligations under international law. Later in the day, Mike Pompeo also visited the occupied Golan Heights, which Israel seized from Syria in a 1967 war. President Trump recognized Israel's sovereignty over the region last year. Pompeo's Thursday visits drew the ire of the Palestinians. A spokesman for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas slammed the U.S. labeling move as a violation of international law. Also, senior member of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Wassel Abu Youssef, said Pompeo's labeling announcement, quote, reaffirms the partnership between U.S. President Trump and the occupation. Another senior PLO member, Hanan Ashrawi, said Mike Pompeo's visit is aimed at setting another illegal precedent. Pompeo's visits to an Israeli settlement and the occupied Golan Heights were controversial enough. However, they are dwarfed by other anti-Palestinian moves taken by the Trump administration in the past 4 years. Trump announced Jerusalem al-Quds as the capital of Israel. Palestinians say the city belongs to them and is the capital of their state. Trump also relocated the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to al-Quds. The American president also showed unprecedented support for Israeli crimes, including bombardment of the Gaza Strip and killing of Palestinians across the occupied territories, setting new precedents in Washington's deep-seated and biased support for the Israeli occupation and crimes against Palestinians.
Millions of businesses across the EU's 27 member states remain closed due to COVID-19. retail, hospitality, and aviation sectors have been decimated by the pandemic.
People who never were really in the risk of poverty are now really at the risk of poverty. They are now queuing up for food aid.
The European Commission has just published its EU Economic Semester Report 2021, and things are not looking good.
We will have an incomplete and uneven recovery over the coming 2 years, and with persistent uncertainty and multiple risks.
The Commission's report highlights how a debt mountain is growing in the EU, particularly in key nations such as Italy and France. Lobby groups are questioning whether financial support packages already announced will be sufficient.
Is it going to start a new growth for Europe and employment for Europe? We are not sure either. So it's a lot of promise. They have to deliver, because otherwise people will be so disappointed and the trust will completely disappear.
The EU is experiencing its sharpest ever decline in employment due to the pandemic, and things were certainly not perfect even before COVID-19. The European Commission says political leaders across the bloc must take decisive action to prevent social catastrophe.
We need a quick agreement on all elements of EU's 1.82 trillion euros recovery package to support the real economy. People and businesses are waiting.
The EU Commission says 4.1 million temporary jobs have been lost in the bloc. Young adults have been impacted most severely.
Suicide rates in the EU are on the up. Therefore, social rights groups say the need for governments to agree on financial support is not just about the economy. It is, in fact, a matter of life and death. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Coronavirus infections among the general population are rapidly rising in the Gaza Strip, with nearly 500 cases being discovered on a daily basis. On Wednesday, 4 deaths were reported and 600 infections were detected, bringing the number of infections to over 12,000. Hospitals in Gaza, meanwhile, are running low on intensive care units and ventilators, as well as medicines and equipment. During a press conference, the Ministry of Interior in Gaza raised the alarm over the rising number of infections.
The Ministry of Interior may be forced to take some extreme and tough measures, including a full lockdown given the high number of daily infections. Today, the rate of infections has increased more than 20% compared with only 5% during the first weeks of a spread of the deadly virus.
Due to the Israeli blockade, nearly 2 million Gazans are under terrible strain, and their worries over the coronavirus have been heavily compounded.
The rapid rise in the number of infections is frightening. Given the current circumstances, we are praying for a miracle to keep us safe during this deadly pandemic.
The blockade has destroyed our economy, and a full lockdown will be catastrophic. I think a partial lockdown is better so that people can make a living amid the dire economic situation.
The coronavirus spread among the general population has taken its toll on the impoverished coastal sliver. A full lockdown was imposed on the Gaza Strip in late August for a period of 2 weeks, after authorities confirmed the first coronavirus cases spread through the community.
During the full lockdown, factories and businesses were completely closed, inflicting a heavy blow on the economic sector of the enclave, which has been battered by the Israeli blockade. All institutions, including civil society organizations, are suffering from lack of funding as poverty and unemployment rates increasing rapidly.
The coronavirus continues to threaten the socio-economic welfare of Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here are bracing themselves for the worst as coronavirus infections continue to increase at a fast pace amid the crippling Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. The Holy Quran addresses the leaders of the Kuffar and their followers in a different manner.
In one ayah, the Holy Quran describes these people as the Imams of Kufr. Fight you, the Imams of Kufr, for their oaths are nothing to them. The Holy Quran, chapter 9, verse 12. In one part of Surah Al-Qasas, God describes them as leaders inviting to the fire. And we made them leaders inviting to the fire, and on the day of judgment, no help shall they find. Chapter 28, verse 41. They drag the people into hell. In fact, the severity with which the Holy Quran describes the enemies of Islam and of the Kuffar is related to these orientations. All other people from among the Kuffar, those who seek and cherish the truth and who do not show hostility, are the addressees of that beautiful and holy ayah. It grieves him that you should perish. Today, the enemy of Islam, the main enemy, those leaders inviting to the fire, is arrogance and Zionism. It is they who are confronting and fighting against Islam with all their power. The last display of this confrontation is the one that unfortunately took place in Paris last week. That indecent show that was performed in Paris is really noteworthy and significant.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
What kind of government is the French government? What policy does it have? This policy is the same policy that has offered shelter to the most violent and savage terrorists in the world, the terrorists who martyred a president in our country and his prime minister. They martyred the head of the judiciary branch, many members of parliament and executive and judiciary officials. According to the figures that are available, they also martyred about 17,000 ordinary people on the streets and in the bazaars. They are not ordinary terrorists, and they have sought shelter in France and Paris. That is why the French claim to be supporting human rights and freedom. The same government offered the most help to a bloodthirsty wolf named Saddam.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. More victims now, the U.S.-led coalition of war on terror are being identified. This time, 39 Afghan civilians who were killed in 2002 are most likely to have been killed illegally by Australian Special Forces. Now, this is according to a four-year investigation by Australian Defence Force after complaints by Afghan and Australian nationals to investigate. So what does it all mean now? Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate.
The Australian military is under fire following the release of a damning report this week that has found credible evidence of war crimes in Afghanistan. The long-awaited report, based on a four-year inquiry, has found evidence that Australian Special Forces killed dozens of Afghan prisoners, farmers, or other civilians. The findings of the inquiry, carried out by the Australian Defence Force, reveal a twisted and extreme warrior culture among the elite of the Australian Armed Forces who were deployed to Afghanistan. The commandos were supposed to fight militants thousands of kilometers away from Australia, but many of them now stand accused of engaging in a methodical campaign to kill unarmed Afghans and conceal it. In one instance, the inquiry has found evidence that platoon commanders told junior soldiers to get their first kill by shooting prisoners. An academic who carried out initial research into the atrocities believes that they were, quote, deliberate, repeated, and targeted war crimes. The inquiry findings show that some of the soldiers who are accused of committing these war crimes are still serving in the Australian military. The report has been highly redacted, and many details of the atrocities remain unknown. But its authors have admitted that they probably failed to uncover all crimes committed during a period of time under investigation. They have recommended a mechanism to collect and assess further allegations of atrocities in Afghanistan. The findings are deeply embarrassing for the Australian government, which is a vociferous critic of rights abuses around the world. The government initially tried to suppress whistleblowers and local media that had tried to bring the alleged war crimes to public attention. Australian authorities tried hard to keep a lid on this story when it first emerged in 2017. That year, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation published shocking allegations of unlawful killings of unarmed Afghans, including children, based on leaked military documents. The Australian Federal Police raided the office of the national broadcaster and tried in vain to prosecute the journalists who blew the whistle on the killings. The story now seems to have turned into a major scandal. The latest findings are a painful legacy of America's longest war. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001 has resulted in nearly two decades of war. A very large number of Afghan civilians, including children, have lost their lives in American and U.S.-led airstrikes and operations. The U.S.-led military campaign has failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with an endless list of problems. The United States itself is being investigated for possible war crimes in Afghanistan. The ICC probe began earlier this year after a preliminary report found reasons to believe war crimes had been committed during the war. U.S. President Donald Trump, who was infuriated by the investigation, imposed sanctions on the court. His decision drew worldwide condemnation. Observers believe that the U.S. must have a lot to worry about as the International Criminal Court investigates its actions during the war in Afghanistan.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer out of London and journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, let's start it off in London with Jonathan. What did you think about the findings of this investigation, and were you surprised at all that these type of abuses had taken place?
Obviously, the reports are very shocking indeed, even though it was somewhat redacted. There's enough information in there to really raise huge questions over the whole nature of the operations of the special forces of the Australian Army in Afghanistan. The good thing is the report has come out, and also that the head of the Defence Services has apologised. But of course, an apology is nothing like enough. There will be prosecutions, and that must be prosecutions. But it shouldn't only be the younger soldiers who end up being prosecuted, because I think clearly the command chain goes higher, including perhaps into the political sphere of the leadership in Australia. And there needs to be a very, very careful investigation as to exactly how this sort of policy came about, where, as was mentioned in the introductory piece, for example, there would be what was called blooding. Young recruits just arriving would be told to shoot a prisoner in order to get them used to killing civilians, which is clearly a war crime.
Well, Brett, in the report it states about that war culture that our guest in London just was mentioning amongst these elite troops, and the way some troops were anxious to get their first kill. What exactly does that say? I mean, does it appear to you that this would just be something isolated, and these troops were not following orders? Do you think this is just isolated with these individuals, or do you think that the responsibility goes further up the ladder?
I think it definitely runs further than just the rank-and-file troops that have committed these atrocities. Indeed, as has been mentioned and as was written in the report, in many cases, these were initiation rituals of a kind. You know, young soldiers, grunts who come into combat for the first time, who are being told to basically get their hands dirty immediately in one of the most gruesome ways possible by murdering either civilians or unarmed prisoners. And, of course, this order had to come from someone, and so this order came most likely from the officers, and the officer staff, of course, responds to an even higher brass of higher officers and higher-ups, that I think it's very unlikely, if this was such a relatively commonplace occurrence, as seems to be hinted in the report, it would be very unlikely that the higher brass did not know about this, and that the military leadership was in the dark about this. I think this is, on the contrary, this speaks to a very typical and very problematic culture of extreme nationalism and jingoism in not just Australia, and not Australia in particular even, but in the Western armed forces that have been active in the Middle East in general and in Central Asia in the past few decades. This is a typical sort of mentality that you see also expressed in the United States military, I believe also in the British military, and in many of the troops that and armies in general, army command structures of the nations that are active in the conflict in, for example, Afghanistan, but also in Iraq. Because what you see is a form of result, what I would call a result of decades of massive propaganda, of dehumanization of the enemy, and not just of the enemy, but of the people living in the country. Mm-hmm. This is no longer crimes committed against people who fought necessarily against this, these troops. These are not just Taliban soldiers or Daesh or whatever extremists that are being targeted. These are very often civilians. There have been numerous cases of footage being published in which soldiers, usually American soldiers, are traveling through the countryside in Afghanistan and just murder some farmers or some goat herders or shepherds along the way, because they know that there is very little chance of this really going viral, let's say, because they, for them, these are just illiterate peasants that they can do with whatever they want. This is a problem of mentality, a problem of mindset that's all pervasive in the military structure of many Western societies.
What about that, Jonathan? I mean, do you think in general this U.S.-led coalition, and in this case we're talking about the Australian side of things, but in general that, as our other guest was alluding to, that they have this superiority type of attitude when dealing with the other, especially, for example, dealing with Afghans, and basically not even looking at these people as human sometimes?
Yes, I'm sure that's right. Brett is absolutely correct to focus on the dehumanization of the other in these sorts of conflict situations. The fact that they're of different ethnicity, the fact that they are Muslims in most cases, also plays into this narrative of some countries, including the United States, that see them therefore as the enemy, whether they are actually armed resistance or terrorists or just ordinary farmers going about their own business. And there seems to have been such an acceptance of that situation in Afghanistan, by no means only by the Australians, that poor Afghans who were confronted with these sorts of situations often didn't even complain because they thought it would be a complete waste of time, that there was a culture of impunity, and the well-armed Westerners, whether they were Australians, Americans, or indeed British, would always be able to have their way, and that the best way to escape problems was to remain quiet and out of sight. So there is a real problem, and it's not only in Afghanistan. We saw incidents like that in Iraq as well. For example, the way that Americans treated people in Abu Ghraib prison, you may recall, appalling scenes of degradation and dehumanization. And this is something that really Western countries, including Britain, have got to come to terms with and to stamp out.
Well, Brett, the acts that, actually crimes that we're talking about happened 18 years ago. Why do you think it's taken so long to expose this when Afghan families have been complaining from the very beginning about the abuses of U.S.-led coalition forces there?
Well, I think it's a combination of general problems, of course, getting information like this out to the world, but combined with a far more important and far more destructive problem being the policy of keeping a lid on everything. As has been said in the beginning of the report, indeed, by the reporter on the scene, is that when ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, reported on this in 2017 in the first place, their offices were raided and the journalist was for a while threatened basically to be treated as, for example, Julian Assange or Edward Snowden were when they basically blew a whistle on certain crimes that were being committed in the country or by people of the country's nationality. So this is, when you see that this is how far they will go in broad daylight in Australia already, you can only begin to imagine how far they will go in order to keep this under, to swipe this under the rug when it's being said in Afghanistan. You can imagine if a farmer or a shepherd in Afghanistan goes to complain to the authorities, to the police forces, even if it's the Afghan local authorities, the chances are very high, of course, that this complaint will be noticed by the occupying forces, the foreign forces that are being talked about, in this case, the Australians. So, of course, there is no evidence of a violent crackdown on people who are trying to explain their story. But I don't think it would be very far-fetched to believe that these people are likely threatened with violence, threatened with more dangerous acts if they try to get their story known. And indeed, as Mr. Fryer said, the problem is that many of these people, after a while, probably just gave up trying to complain about it in general, because what's the point of trying to get your story out. If you know, the lid will be trying to, they will try to put the lid on it constantly. And that result is that, fortunately, we have had some good journalists now, Australian journalists who have finally decided to publish the story. But it will, of course, it has taken years for these people to dig through the mud in order to get what they needed in order to publish this report. That's the result of it.
Right. And Jonathan, at the end of the day, do you think that any measures will really be taken against these soldiers? Will these soldiers be charged with murder, you think?
Well, I think certainly there will be prosecutions. Whether they will be found guilty and sentenced to long periods of prison is another matter. But I think there certainly will be prosecutions. It would be very difficult for the Australian government to avoid putting some troops on trial because of the public opinion and international opinion, which would demand that some people have to bear responsibility. As I mentioned earlier, the problem is how high up the line should this go? Because obviously the higher it goes, then the less likelihood there is of any proper retribution against the people who are responsible for the policy, which does stem into the whole of the war on terror narrative. In other words, that if you're in a situation where you're dealing against with terrorists, that anything goes, and that means that ordinary civilians who probably have nothing whatsoever to do with any extreme group get caught up in this. So I think it's very important for international law that Australia takes a stand, and that other countries, including Britain, also look their own special forces and really see whether this problem is wider and whether how it can be rooted out.
Well, Brett, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison now has apologized directly to Afghan President Ashraf Ghani about what he called these abuses. But what does that mean at the end of the day? What do you think is going to happen?
Of course, the problem is that it's very easy to apologize for something that happened. The question here is, of course, if you not just, you know, talk the talk, but also walk the walk. And that's something that Australia has to prove now. They have to show to the world that they take this seriously, that these people will be tried for the crimes that they have committed. And indeed, this in many cases, this would definitely include the charge of murder or at least manslaughter. And not just, you know, crimes that not just like abuses that were committed in the time of war, because that makes it sound like there are circumstances that would justify these actions. And I don't think these things are justifiable, no matter under which circumstances they happen. The other problem, of course, is the question remains how far Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan, will go in order to pursue this, because we have seen time and again that the Afghan government is not always necessarily a stable government and is in many cases and in many ways very dependent, of course, on these foreign troops that are keeping it in power. There is very often a problem of popular support that is very much lacking popular support for this government. And as a result, it is very difficult, I think, for the it is very unlikely, I mean, to hope that these Afghan politicians will really try to pressure what they perceive as their Western allies into really pursuing this very much. Of course, I could be mistaken, and I hope I will be. But this goes much further than just apologizing and saying sorry that this happened. These people have to be brought to justice. Recompensation should be paid to the families of the victims. And in general, actually, recompensation should be paid to Afghanistan, because this is running into their hundreds of billions of dollars that Afghanistan has been suffering in both economic terms and, of course, in manpower and in population. A lot of people that have been massacred as a result of this unnecessary war ever since 2001. Mm-hmm. So this is a general problem that has to be solved in a way that is much more fundamental. And that is something in which I fear that is unlikely to happen, because if we bring it back to the leader of this coalition, the United States, we have to bear in mind the United States has never even recompensated Vietnam for the crimes they had committed there 40, 50 years ago. So
right.
the chances that they could do this anytime soon to Afghanistan are, I'm afraid, quite slim.
Well, Jonathan, are there double standards in the way U.S. allies are held responsible for war crimes as opposed to those fighting against the U.S.?
Well, I mean, a war crime is a war crime, whoever carries it out, whether it's the US or any of their allied forces in a country like Afghanistan, or any extremist group. In the news bulletin, you mentioned today's attacks from Daesh on Kabul again, yet more civilians killed in that attack. And certainly they need to be held to account as well, but it's much more difficult because, of course, you can't often identify where is the chain of command and who are really carrying out these atrocities. But the whole idea of setting up the International Criminal Court several years ago, which Trump so dislikes, is the idea that there are international standards, and these should apply to governments, to armies, and to non-state actors. And it's very important, I think, that this principle be bolstered by appropriate judicial action, and that the climate of impunity in a war situation is removed, because surely in the 21st century we should have realized that it's no longer possible to justify many things which perhaps our ancestors considered perfectly normal, but which we don't.
Which we don't. What do you think about that, Brett? Things that ancestors didn't consider normal, but which we don't. However, if we look at the world of 2020 and we see the imbalance of it all, how much have we progressed? When we look at this situation, at the end of the day, don't you think, according to international standards, that the life of an Afghan is not going to be held the same as for as an American soldier being killed or an Aussie soldier being killed or a Brit being killed on the ground? Isn't there a difference when we see terrorist attacks and how we react when they're committed in Afghanistan as opposed to a terrorist attack in Europe or some of these other Western countries?
Yeah, this is, I believe that is undeniably true. There is a massive amount of hypocrisy in general, in international media, mainstream media mostly, in international politics, even in international diplomacy. There is a massive issue that we have, what we have seen over and over again, that when a terrorist attack happens, for example, in Brussels or in Paris, this is worldwide news. This goes on to dominate world politics for years sometimes. Whereas these sort of attacks that have been taking place, for example, in Paris, they happen on a weekly basis in some areas in the Middle East, for example, and in many cases, those same sort of attacks of that magnitude are being committed by the Western powers that are mourning the attacks that are taking place in the West. Now, the problem is that there is this massive double standard that unfortunately has seeped very much into the ICC as well. The ICC has been doing some good work ever since it was founded, undeniably so. But there is an undeniable focus on certain third world leaders of certain third world countries. There is a reason why in some regions of Africa, the ICC is jokingly called the International Caucasian Court, because it's something that it's a court that is perceived as a very Eurocentric court that specifically targets leaders of in Africa mostly, or in Yugoslavia, be leaders of third world countries, of countries that are not part of the hegemonic powers, and that these people, for their crimes or perceived crimes, are being dragged to The Hague in order to be tried. But it's very almost unheard of to see this pressure, the same sort of status, the same sort of rules being applied to people and rulers of first world countries. For example, George W. Bush, for example, the crimes committed by President Obama, who even received the Nobel Peace Prize right before he went on to, murder people in Syria and in Libya. So this is there is a massive hypocrisy at play here that is embedded in a way, of course, in the United Nations very often, in the veto power being wielded by certain permanent members of the Security Council.
All right. And on that note, so sorry to interrupt you, but we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer out of London, journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Hazant. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on Another Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
For Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In stacking not just his DHS team but all of his transition teams with neoliberals and hawks, Biden has sent the world a clear signal that despite the cage-free fantasies of liberal Democrats, his immigration policy will be more of the same, says Adrian Pine, writer, in an article published under the heading More Humane Cages? Prospects for immigration justice under Biden appears dim. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Variants of the theme of caged children were used to try to shame leftists into voting for Biden in the recent presidential elections, despite the fact that, as President Trump repeatedly and correctly noted in a twisted defense of his own family separation policy, the Obama-Biden White House started the program. Instead of a reprieve from policies that fall squarely within the definition of genocide, Biden appears poised to dig in his heels. Take, for example, his appointment of Obama's former top immigration advisor, Cecilia Muñoz, to his transition team, who brushed off NPR interviewer Maria Hinojosa's question about family separation, responding that some of these things are going to happen. While much has been made of the gender diversity of Biden's transition team, including Muñoz and potential cabinet picks, it will be little comfort to the women of Central America or any other region subject to U.S. interference to know that the new U.S. girl bosses may include Susan Rice as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton as U.N. Ambassador, or Michelle Flournoy as Secretary of Defense. Many of Biden's DHS transition team selections show his platform will differ, if at all, only in form, not in substance, from that of Trump. None of his team members hail from the ranks of BIPOC organizers who delivered him his victories in key states like Arizona and for whom immigration is a major issue. Instead, Biden's picks feather the logic of his Latino campaign strategy, which pandered to right-wing Miami Cubans and Venezuelans, ignoring the vast, diverse majority of Latino communities for whom immigration, justice, access to quality health care and education, and protection from police violence are far more important than fighting communism. While numerous analysts on the left have pointed out that Biden's approach didn't even win him Florida, he's sticking to it. Biden's DHS transition team members range from billionaire-funded think tank pundits to corporate lawyers, with a smattering of left liberal ACLU types, none of whom fundamentally question the overarching logic of border security. Take blasts known as NATO, for example. DHS transition team member and RAND analyst who accuses migrants of taking advantage of incentives created by the U.S. asylum process and has advocated that asylum seekers be made to seek asylum from U.S. embassies while still living in their countries. A non-starter for people fleeing deadly violence and building more private prisons to detain entire families indefinitely as humane alternatives to family separation. Beyond the more egregious stances taken by some of Biden's DHS transition committee members, they appear to be in agreement on some fundamental and fundamentally flawed points, all of which prioritize profit over human lives. For Biden's DHS team, border security, that is, preventing people without legitimate asylum claims from entering the United States, is at least as important as ensuring that the militarized security apparatus doesn't kill mostly BIPOC people on either side of the U.S. border. Privatized border security expenditures of public funds should continue at least at their current levels, shifting focus from Trump's extension of Obama-Biden's physical border walls toward ever-increasing spending on equally harmful technologies of surveillance. Migration deterrence measures should follow the logic of the Biden plan for Central America, investing hundreds of millions of dollars into repressive state security apparatuses and mega development projects, despite the plan having dramatically increased impoverishment, state violence, and migration since its implementation in response to the 2014 unaccompanied minor crisis and climate change, which is dramatically increasing migration and should be taken into account in immigration policy, is not a result of capitalism and thus should not be addressed by curbing or ending it. To understand the dangers to immigrants of the likely Biden administration, it's also important to look beyond the DHS transition team to his other transition team picks. U.S. capitalist military imperialism in partnership with client governments and in regime change efforts against non-client states is the primary push factor for immigration to this country. Journalists Sarah Lazar, Alan McLeod, and Kevin Cazola have shown in recent days how Biden has already handed the reins over to the same war hawks and authors of neoliberal trade deals responsible for impoverishment, violence, and environmental devastation abroad, and consequently immigration to the United States. The defense contractors so heavily represented in Biden's transition team will profit as much from border security initiatives as they do from foreign wars. The intertwined success and violence of U.S. asylum deportation industry hinges on its profitability. In stacking not just his DHS team, but all of his transition teams with neoliberals and hawks, Biden has sent the world a clear signal that despite the cage-free fantasies of liberal Democrats, his immigration policy will be more of the same.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.